welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. A revolution has taken place in the family since the late 1960s, and not necessarily a positive one. The changes have produced alarm, anxiety, and apprehension. But as our guests this week, Stephen Mintz and Stephanie Kuntz, suggest, the American family has gone through other periods of considerable change in the past, and our memory of what the family was once like may be more the product of nostalgia than reality. But before we get to that subject, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On September 20, 1947, one of New York City's greatest mayors died, thus ending a distinguished political career that spanned 30 years. Fiorello LaGuardia, probably most remembered today for the New York airport that bears his name, was nationally renowned as an honest, nonpartisan, progressive reformer. Just over 5 feet tall, with a high-pitched voice, a colorful personality, and a flair for drama, LaGuardia began his career in 1916 when he was elected to the U.S. Congress. He earned a reputation as a force to be reckoned with in the fight against prohibition, organized crime, and racism, and was reelected 4 times. In 1934, he became New York City's 99th mayor, and for the next 11 years transformed the city in the grip of political corruption, organized crime, poor administration, and few social and health services. Under his leadership, massive federal funding was used to construct bridges, reservoirs, sewer systems, parks, highways, schools, hospitals, health centers, and airports. For the first time, public housing was offered to New York's poor. A unified public transit system was provided for the working class, and artists and musicians were given training and subsidies. When he died, Fiorello LaGuardia, the little flower, was hailed as the father of modern New York. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, for over 300 years, the Mongol hordes kept most of Asia and some of Europe at bay under their mighty swords. Genghis Khan, the legendary warrior leader who started a series of conquests that formed the largest contiguous land empire in history, is the subject of fascination and legend even today, nearly 800 years after his death. An American-Mongolian expedition has discovered a walled burial ground 200 miles northeast of the Mongolian capital, Ulaanbaatar, a burial site they believe to be Genghis Khan's place of rest. For centuries, the site's location has remained a secret, but today scholars are optimistic that the excavation will solve this age-old mystery. The Hasbro Toy Company's ever-popular G.I. Joe action figure represents to millions of young Americans the ideal of the American soldier hero. The latest version of the G.I. Joe bears the likeness of the late Roy P. Benavidez, a Hispanic Army sergeant who won the Medal of Honor for saving 8 lives during a jungle battle in Vietnam. Hispanic leaders hailed the move as a step toward incorporating more American ethnic minorities into the nation's soldier ideal. In May 1968, Benavidez, with a wounded right leg, face, head, stomach, and back, managed to make several helicopter trips carrying injured soldiers to safety. In 1981, he was rewarded for his heroism with the Congressional Medal of Honor. He died in November 1998. This is Talking History. Few subjects are more shrouded in myths, misconceptions, and misleading generalizations than the history of the family. Americans are prone to romanticizing the past and confusing historical fantasy and reality, and this is especially true when Americans ponder our society's bedrock institution, the family. So writes our guest today, Stephen Mintz, in his introduction to the summer issue of the Organization of American Historians Magazine of History, whose theme is Family History. Mintz is Senior Associate Dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Social Sciences and John Rebecca Moore's Professor of History at the University of Houston. He's also the author of Domestic Revolutions, A Social History of the American Family. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
Why do you think Americans are so prone to romanticizing the family?
Brian, in this country, we have a sunny, simplistic, overly sentimentalized view of the past. It's a view reinforced by flawed memory, faded photographs, and especially television reruns. In a society beset by constant change, it's reassuring to imagine a time when life was more stable. We remember the good side of the past, but we forget the uglier realities. We remember the roaring 20s, but we forget Leopold and Loeb. We need to remember that television sitcoms are not documentaries. In real life, families like those of Ozzie and Harriet suffered from many of the same problems as families today. Substance abuse, spousal conflict, stress.
So what harm does it do, though, if we tend to look at life in the past as being the life of Ozzie and Harriet?
Our romanticization of the past leads us to minimize the real gains that have taken place in family life in recent years. The growing amounts of income that parents invest in their children, and especially the increasing involvement of fathers in their children's lives. But this romanticization has also led to highly unrealistic expectations of what family life should be like. And finally, it also encourages us to scapegoat those families that deviate from dominant norms. We seldom try to understand why families of different social classes take different forms.
Okay, you mentioned we've made gains, but I think some people would quickly respond, but look at what we've lost as of late, the revolutionary changes that haven't always been for the best for the family. Does your research bear out those changes?
Brian, in a 10-year period, from the late 1960s to the late 1970s, American family life was totally transformed. We went through a series of wrenching upheavals that we're all familiar with. Divorce rates doubled. The proportion of wives working outside the home doubled. The number of single-parent homes tripled. The number of couples cohabitating outside of marriage quadrupled. In other words, in the span of a decade, the norms that had governed the family for 150 years suddenly were shattered.
But in your article, you also make the point that although these changes have been rather dramatic, the history of the family as a whole has been subject to great change. Has the change been more dramatic recently, or is it just sort of a continuation of change over the centuries?
Brian, we're not the first generation to live through disruptive changes in family life. At the end of the 18th century, at the end of the 19th century, just as at the end of the 20th century, family life changed profoundly. At the end of the 18th century, America went through what I would call its first domestic revolution. Patriarchal authority within the family broke down. A growing number of young people married without their parents' consent. A majority of women were actually pregnant before their wedding day. And upwards of 10% of all births were outside of wedlock. Another domestic revolution took place at the end of the 19th century. The divorce rate tripled in the last decades of the 19th century, and one-tenth of all families were single-parent homes. In addition, at least 100,000 children were living in institutions like orphanages then. And even in the 20th century, family life has undergone repeated far-reaching changes. The Great Depression resulted in hundreds of thousands of husbands deserting their wives and hundreds of thousands of children living by themselves out on the road. World War II also subjected families to severe stresses, which resulted in high divorce rates, latchkey children, sharp rises in teen pregnancy, venereal disease, and juvenile delinquency. In other words, change is nothing new.
So if it's nothing new, and you certainly make a point for some rather dramatic challenges to the family in the past, you're suggesting that if we go back and just better understand perhaps these changes and what brought them about, we will be better able to deal with the current changes.
What Americans need to understand is that the recent developments in family life did not emerge overnight. They are the product of long-term historical processes that we can understand. There are three changes that I think are the most striking in American family life, and they didn't begin in the licentious 1960s, but have deep historical roots. One is the rising divorce rate. The divorce rate reached 10,000 in 1867 and has risen very steadily since then, the only exception being the 1950s when the divorce rate was steady. And the reason the divorce rate rose was because we believe in marriages for love, we believe in marriages for happiness, and divorce is the escape hatch, that allows people to leave loveless and abusive marriages. The second major development is the decline of the birth rate. The birth rate has declined fairly steadily since 1810. Indeed, the biggest drop in the birth rate took place in the 19th century, not in the 20th century, as birth rates fell from an average of 7 to 10 down to 3 among middle class, a tremendous drop. And again, this reflected deep historical processes. It reflected the fact that children were no longer economic assets, but were rather investments that required a great deal of parental money in the form of education and other inputs. And finally, the third major development is the entry of mothers into the wage workforce. As recently as 1940, just 4% of mothers, white mothers, were in the wage workforce. But World War II was the revolution that changed that, as for the first time, a majority of the women in the workforce were married women. And so even in 1960, one-third of middle-class women were already in the workforce. In some ways, feminism was a product of the disparity, of the gap between our ideology of women and the realities of women's lives.
So the family hardly exists in isolation. It's really very much a product of the times, the history, the economics, the immigration of people from abroad. All of these come to bear on redefining and causing change.
The family, I believe, can best be understood as a kind of lightning rod, which has absorbed all of the social transformations over the past two centuries.
Okay, we don't have time to go into a lot of depth on this, but let me take you back. As I'm looking at your article here, you divide up the history of the family into sections. Tell me a little bit about the colonial family.
In theory, the colonial family was a patriarchal unit in which the father was invested with total authority. He alone sat in an armchair, while other family members sat on stools or benches. He slept in the household's biggest bed. He had to consent to his children's marriages. In New England, the law even said that he had the right to put a child to death who cursed him. It wasn't carried out in practice, I should note. But in fact, the colonial family was a very flexible unit in which the roles of men and women were often surprisingly interchangeable. But the colonial family was different from our families in other ways as well. Typical mother, as I said, bore between 7 and 10 children. She'd have her first child around the age of 21 and her last child in her mid-40s. These children would typically leave home between the ages of 7 and 15. To work as servants in other people's households. But perhaps the most striking difference between the colonial period and our own is that American colonists were not supposed to marry for love. Love was supposed to follow marriage. Rather, couples were supposed to marry for pragmatic reasons.
And what happened to that ideal with independence and the creation of the American Republic?
A very different kind of family began to emerge in the early 19th century. This is the family that we call the traditional family, but which is in fact only 200 or 150 years old. It consists of a go-to-work father, stay-at-home mother, and children who remain home into their late teens or early 20s. It is a unit based on romantic love, but it is also a unit it's shaped by a very different kind of economy. Instead of a farm household in which all family members contribute to its well-being, you begin to have work moving some distance from the home, and so you have a separation between the place of home and the place of work, which 19th century Americans confused with the separation between the male sphere and the female sphere.
At the end of the 19th and into the early years of the 20th century, the nation goes through major changes again, industrialization, urbanization, immigration. What impact did this have on the family?
It had enormous impact. And here I think it's crucial to recognize that the urban middle class family was only a small minority of families in America. Most families had a collective family economy in which all family members, including children, were expected to contribute to the family's support. So in most working class families in the 19th century, children under the age of 15 contributed upwards of 20% to the family income. They worked not because their parents were heartless, but because these families could simply not survive without the children's contribution. But in the early 20th century, this vision of the collaborative family economy began to break down. New notions of a male family wage led working class families to increasingly approximate the middle class ideal of a single male breadwinner.
In your article, you allude to the difficulty of talking about what I would consider to be the difficulty of talking about an institution like the family when it can vary so dramatically based on class and race. And I was wondering, perhaps you could comment a bit on that. What would be some of the exceptions, for example, if we talk about the African-American family in the 20th century?
Here, again, it is crucial to distinguish on the basis of class, because African-American families are no more uniform than any other families in our society. But when we're talking about poor families, it's very important to understand that they exist in a network of supportive kin and non-kin, or what we sometimes call fictive kin. That is, the group that usually consists of a mother and her children exists in a very supportive network in which the mother sometimes will place her children temporarily in the care of other relatives or non-relatives, where there's an expectation of support coming from other families. It's very important, I think, for us to understand how the shaping social context affects family life. And so when families are under severe economic stress, they relate in different ways to the resources around them.
You alluded earlier to the many challenges, or perhaps I don't want to overstate it, the changes, considerable changes, that have faced the family since the 1960s. And we've also talked about the importance of understanding the history of the family. So let me ask you to put that together and to talk a bit about your view as an historian of the American family today as to its current state, and perhaps, and I know historians don't have crystal balls, but where you think it's going.
There is a widespread view, Brian, that the family is going to hell in a handbasket, that parents are growing less concerned about their children, that children are growing more alienated from their parents, and that people are turning to more flexible, less demanding relationships to replace marriage. It's not true. There is no evidence at all to support the view that Americans today are less invested or committed to marriage than at any time in the past. Over 90% of women eventually marry. The overwhelming majority of women have children. In other words, the commitment to family is strong. But I would argue that our rising expectations of what a family should provide have made the family a more fragile institution than in the past. Families in the 19th century or in the 18th century were knit together because of economic need. The glue that held families together was the fact that they were the fundamental consumption unit, but also the fundamental productive unit in society. Those kinds of economic supports have weakened, and that's made the family a more fragile institution. But what holds the family together are emotional bonds.
Okay, that's a great point to leave it. You summarized what we need to remember very well. So thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure to be with you.
You've been listening to Stephen Mintz, Senior Associate Dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Social Sciences and Moore's Professor of History at the University of Houston. Mintz is also the author of Does the American Family Have a History? The Introduction to the Summer 2001 issue of the Organization of American Historians Magazine of History. And this is Talking History.
Yeah.
As we just heard, the American family has changed dramatically over the years. But our next guest adds, our memories of the family in the past have often been emotionally charged and highly mythologized, usually to pose unfavorable and erroneous comparisons to the American family today. She's Stephanie Kuntz, a family historian at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and the co-chair of the Council on Contemporary Families. She's the author of The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap, published by Basic Books, and The Challenge of Family History, which appeared in the summer 2001 issue of the Organization of American Historians Magazine of History.
When you ask kids to list the good and bad things about their summer vacation right after it's over, the lists tend to be equally long. But as time goes by, the good list grows longer and the bad shorter, until after a while the children are describing not their actual vacation, but their idealized image of vacation, with a capital V. The same thing happens with families. For most Americans, the idealized image of family, with a capital F, that overpowers the real experience of their own families in the past is the Leave It to Beaver model, you know, where mom stays home all day equipped with an endless supply of milk, cookies, and patience, where dad never comes home from work too grumpy to dispense words of wisdom, where the kids are always eager to accept parental advice, and where, supposedly as a consequence, everyone is kept safe from the perils of the outside world. Now, I can understand a certain amount of nostalgia for a time before emails and beepers invaded our home life, for a time when the average 30-year-old man could buy a median-priced home on just 15 to 18% of his annual salary, when parents didn't have to fight with their kids over R-rated movies and videos, when the nightly news wasn't full of sex scandals or child abuse or domestic violence. But there are a couple things to remember before we let nostalgia run away with us. To begin with, many of the families that succeeded in the 1950s only did so because of the incredibly generous subsidies that the government then handed out to young families, a support system that has since been dismantled. And even with all that help, 50 families had their fair share of problems. Think about the massive racial discrimination that kept 50% of black married couple families below the poverty line, or the daily violence that went unreported because it was directed at African Americans and Puerto Ricans, who were pretty much considered legitimate targets, or the systematic discrimination against women and the cover-up of family abuse. You know, when women in the 1950s told therapists they'd been molested by their fathers, they were typically told they'd imagined it. It was just an unconscious Oedipal fantasy. When police responded to domestic violence calls, they often asked the woman what she'd done to provoke the fight. And when kids came to emergency room with broken bones, very few physicians tried to find out whether they'd been beaten by their parents. This was also a period when people with unconventional political views were hounded out of jobs and even sent to jail, a time when gays, lesbians, and single mothers were discriminated against in nearly every arena of life. Certainly, since the 1950s, we've created some new problems for families, partly in the process of solving old ones, partly as the downside of some of the gains we've made. There are no easy answers to many of these problems. But then again, there never were. One of the most important lessons of history is that we have to keep our eyes fixed on the future rather than seeking a golden age in the past.
You've been listening to Stephanie Kuntz, a family historian at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and the co-chair of the Council on Contemporary Families. This is Talking History. Family history is a hot topic, and as a result, many sources of information have been made available to you. The Organization of American Historians has put together a list of some of the best internet sources on family history. And here to tell you about that listing is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
In the summer issue of the OAH Magazine of History, you will find a wonderful piece on selected internet resources on family history. Listed are many sites that deal with slave families, families in the early republic, shifting family ideals, families in the Great Depression, families in World War II, including an online photo album containing pictures documenting the daily lives of Japanese American families in internment camps in the U.S. and Canada. The OAH Magazine of History is available at your local library and can be ordered from the Organization of American Historians website at oah.org.
And finally, turning to our segment on coming attractions, tourists got more than their kicks on Route 66. Those who drove the original U.S. Route 66, which spanned 2,400 miles, loaded up their Model Ts and later their Nash Ramblers with souvenirs, rubber tomahawks, plastic jewelry, cookie jars shaped like teepees, and salt and pepper shakers shaped like American Indians and war bonnets. A cavalcade of kitsch, a cornucopia of camp, maybe not. In conjunction with the famed highway's 75th anniversary, the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture in Santa Fe, New Mexico, has organized an exhibit that celebrates the art of the Mother Road. The exhibit contains hundreds of items which invited visitors to follow the historic route from Chicago to Santa Monica, California, but also into the cultural divide that marked the Southwest. Much of Route 66 ran through American Indian territory. The flood of novelties sold at diners, service stations, and tourist courts often were American Indian made or had American Indian themes. Collectors were horrified, dismissing the souvenirs as junk. Not so, say the curators. Even the imported curios that presented a distorted view of American Indians, they argue, have their place in history. You be the judge at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Native American Kitsch closes in February 2002. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.